It's my pleasure to introduce Ian MacDonald and an individual and a name that is well known to you all. Ian has fine insights into the happenings of the day, and he sets them in a wonderful historical context. He has done that as an author, and he has done it, my association with Ian, most impressively as a person who puts wonderful words into the mouth of political leaders. And he has done that for a long time, and I can still remember some of those phrases.
Nice to see you, Bob. Thank you, Bob. It's, first of all, an honor to be here with my friend Bob Slater, a great Canadian. If we have an acid rain accord with the United States, the 20th anniversary of which we observe next March, it is due in no small measure to the outstanding leadership that Bob provided when he was senior associate deputy minister for policy at Environment Canada. And I can tell you an anecdote. In 1988, we were working on a speech for the prime minister to the United States Congress, a joint address as they call it, and a major part of the address was about acid rain. And we were trying to dramatize the issue in a way that the get the attention of the Americans. And so we put a line in along the following lines. Acid rain falls on the White House. It falls on the roof of this building, the Capitol Dome. And it falls on the lake in New Hampshire where they filmed on Golden Pond. And I sent the draft to 24 Sussex in the briefcase. And late that night, the phone rang and it was him. And in that famous baritone, he said, "Where did you get that?" And I said, "From Slater." And he said, "Okay." But then he pulled out, in the delivery, he pulled out the line about on Golden Pond. And afterwards, back at the Madison Hotel in Washington, I asked the Prime Minister, "Why did you take that out?" He said, "I wanted to share that as an anecdote with Reagan because Henry Fonda is his best friend." So thank you, Bob. Bob wears the Order of Canada, and believe me, he earned it. We have, we saw Nick's research. It kind of sets the table. It's in the special issue of policy options that's in your delegate kit. And we have an outstanding panel to kind of do a reality check on water and the importance to which we attach to it. As you can see from Nick's poll, it's a very emotional issue. People take ownership of water. It's associated with other issues such as Arctic sovereignty and so on. But we do take it for granted a little bit until sometimes when you see, you know, the Minnesota license plate, land of 10,000 lakes. Heck, we've got a million right here in Quebec. So we are a superpower in water. The question is, what do we do with it? And we have an outstanding panel that we've assembled this morning, Bob Sanford, Jim Bruce, Chris Hilcane, and Karen Baker. And you see their resumes in your conference program. I'm not going to read them through. We're just going to try and whip through their presentations in about 8 to 10 minutes each. We'll hold a clock on them, and then we'll have a wraparound among the presenters, and then we'll get to Q&A. So we'll start with Bob.
In the context of water resources management, there are a host of areas of dispute and potential conflict that we urgently need to address in Canada. We should be dealing with these problems now while time and prosperity are on our side, so that as our population grows and our climate changes, our social and economic development is not limited by water availability and water problems or quality problems we could have and should have addressed in better times. In order to get our water resources management house in order, the first thing we need to do is to dispel some of our own myths before nature does. The first myth we have to dispel is that we are world leaders in the management of water resources. We are not. We are among the world's great water wasters and polluters, and the business opportunity that resides here is in realizing and changing that. Nor do we have as much water as we think. If we do not dispel the myth of limitless water abundance in Canada, we will continue to make contentious public policy choices based on false assumptions of how much water we have that could have undesirable ecological, social, and political consequences in the future. Another myth we have to dispel is that the marketplace will take care of all of our emerging water issues. Better pricing and more open markets will serve to assign water a higher economic value in its economic functions. Better pricing and more open markets generate healthy competition that will discourage wasteful and unproductive uses. Markets alone, however, cannot solve the real problem that we face. The real problem we face is that we lack a set of principles and guidelines that stop us from chipping away at natural systems until there's nothing left of their life-sustaining functions, which the marketplace fails to value adequately, if they're valued at all. Another myth we have to dispel is that proper management of water resources is going to make everybody happy. Very difficult trade-offs will mean that consensus will not be achievable on all water issues. This means that higher levels of government will have to assert leadership on important water matters. To get our house in order and to avoid dispute and potential conflict in the future, we need more consistent, accurate, representative, and relevant monitoring of ground and surface water, and we have to share interpretations derived from such monitoring far more effectively. The alarming state of our country's groundwater resources was put into relief in 2009 in a report by the Council of Canadian Academies. This report evidences the fact that contamination of groundwater aquifers is widespread all over the country. We are even contaminating aquifers that we share with the United States. To get our house in order, we have to understand the link that exists between ground and surface water and stop denying the seriousness of groundwater issues in this country. Most Canadians have yet to make the link between water use and energy costs. Water's heavy. It takes a lot of water to produce energy, and we use a lot of the energy we produce to move water around so it can be available for use when we want it. We can avoid conflict over water use and energy security by understanding the link between the two. If you save one, you're likely saving the other. The management of water resources in the context of continued oil sands development in the Athabasca River Basin is already in dispute and represents an area of elevated conflict that casts Canada in a poor light on the international stage. And regrettably, we appear to have given up trying to resolve that dispute. All sides appear to be relying on public relations to carry the day. The oil sands have become a public relations Afghanistan. It's a war that we could all lose. We simply cannot afford to let crucial water issues be hijacked by the same kind of public relations spin. But that is happening. Even though it may not be visible, a quiet public relations war is being fought in Canada over who's going to have control over our water in the future. This shouldn't surprise us, but it's important to know that, and we have to demand transparency in public discourse over water issues. Legal settlements with the Piikani people related to the Old Man River Dam dispute in Alberta make it clear that First Nations, depending upon the conditions set out in their treaty, can be entitled to water first before any other user. The Piikani settlement could dramatically affect the established first-in-time, first-in-right allocation mechanism on the Great Plains and in other parts of the Canadian West. But it may not just be first in time, first in right that is affected. Many treaties include clauses related to First Nations rights to water quality as well as quantity. And what this suggests is it's only a matter of time before our failure to adequately and consistently address long-standing human rights issues alters existing water allocation and use rights in Western Canada. And as that happens, we should expect conflict. In some parts of Canada, irrigation districts have rights to 70% of the water allocations. To some, that seems like an awful lot. And at the moment, at least, the irrigation community appears to be unwilling to accept that there's anything to dispute. They are standing fiercely by legal interpretations of first-in-time, first-in-right licensing, or FITFER, as it's called. And why not? But when you think about it, it grants them all the water they want first, even in a drought, and even if it means legally denying towns and cities around them the drinking water they need for survival. The running joke outside of agriculture, however, is whether FITFER is fit for the 21st century, but you can bet not everybody's laughing at that joke. There's more to this, though it is almost a heresy to say so. If we want to avoid conflict over water in the future, we need also to improve our agricultural practices. The fact is that certain kinds of agriculture have a big impact on water quality. Agricultural water use is becoming an issue globally because contemporary industrial-scale food production practices inevitably result in reduced return flows to nature of water of poor quality, which diminished and often water-starved natural aquatic ecosystems no longer have the capacity to purify. And this results, of course, in eutrophication. Eutrophication is the nutrient over-enrichment of rivers, streams, and lakes with fertilizers and manure carried by runoff. Thousands of Canadian lakes and watercourses are now suffering from varying degrees of eutrophication. And as we see from Lake Winnipeg, this is not a minor problem. And I predict that unless there are measurable improvements, that within 5 years the Canadian public is going to come to realize that agricultural runoff is one of the biggest contamination threats to the country's surface water resources. There are growing concerns about increasing amounts of endocrine-altering substances finding their way into our water supplies. And in his recent book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It, Robert Glennon reports that up to 90% of the drugs we take leave our bodies unchanged and still active. And although it's a rather crude joke, Glennon goes on to suggest that dirty old men cartoon characterizations won't mean the same thing if men start getting uncontrollable erections from somebody else's Viagra. He then indicates that that will certainly get everybody's attention. So to avoid dispute and conflict, we have to convince the public that reuse technology is necessary, safe, and reliable. We now realize that in order to provide water and other benefits to people, that nature needs water too. Moreover, nature needs a lot more water to provide benefits to people than we thought, and it follows hence that nature can't be where we send water as a last resort. And the first lesson that we might derive from international example is that public policy in Canada would be wise to move forward toward supplying adequate water to nature before over-allocation for human purposes makes it difficult to do so. And I predict in Canada that this will be an explosive issue. While disagreements about science are central to our inaction on climate change, we're now beginning to see also that disputes over climate change are being used as a proxy for much deeper conflicts between opposing ideologies and competing visions of the future. Whether we believe in climate change or not, the Arctic is changing faster than any place on Earth, and the people of the North know that sustainability demands something from everyone, but it won't be long before they grow weary of being among those of whom great sacrifice is tacitly expected, but to whom few benefits flow. If Southerners simply deny that climate change impacts exist, then they don't have to face the moral consequences of destroying the landscapes and livelihoods of their northern neighbors. And to a growing number of observers, that makes climate change denial both immoral and unjust. So sooner or later, the unfair distribution of benefits and burdens associated with climate change impacts will spark conflict, probably right here in Canada. So once again, stay tuned. I believe that all of the areas of potential dispute that I've mentioned can be resolved through patient, mutually respectful collaboration informed by goodwill and sound science. But all the science in the world's not going to help you if you don't use it. We have to act, and I think there are three potential avenues of policy reform. We can revitalize the current system by activating unexercised jurisdiction and harmonizing federal, provincial, and municipal oversight with respect to the management of our water resources. Alternatively, we could water policy reform in Canada could emerge from the example of others. Within the European Water Framework Directive, water quality standards and parameters of aquatic ecosystem health are defined by the European Union. Individual nations are then charged with meeting those standards by whatever means they feel will work best in local circumstances. A third avenue of reform might be to allow regions to reform water policy on a large-scale watershed basis. Integrated regional water policy could emerge at the major basin level, as is occurring now around the Great Lakes. Or alternately, all three options might be combined to create an integrated new Canadian water ethic. In closing, let me say that it's a good time to press for Canadian water ethic. As Nick Nanos pointed out, the majority of Canadians consider water our most important natural resource, even more important to our future than oil. And this was confirmed again in an Ipsos Reid, RBC, and Unilever poll that suggests that the Canadians still feel this way. The point that I would like to make in closing is that, unlike so many other places in the world, Canada still has room to move in terms of how we manage our water resources. We should get moving while we still have that room. Thank you.